Greetings and aggravations, my good and loyal listeners. And welcome to this August 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this lovely and amazing science podcast, Jim Campanella. You guys have no idea how close you were to getting no science podcast this month. I and my family have spent most of the month homeless. That is slightly less melodramatic than it sounds, but only slightly. We've been in the process of buying a new house now for months. The closing date for the purchase of our new home was supposed to be several weeks ago. We prepared everything for the closing, including selling our previous home just prior to the date of the planned new purchase. We changed addresses, utilities, and arranged for the movers. At the last minute, when nothing could be altered on that frenzied downhill flight, we were told by the seller's bank that they were not prepared for the closing they had scheduled, and that we needed to wait. We were told we could move our belongings into the new home, but the sellers, who had long previously fled the state, would not even negotiate for any use and occupancy of said new home. That meant that we could not go back to the house we had just sold, and we could not move into the new home. I will not give you the details on the last several nightmarish weeks that I, my wife, and young children have had to endure until the heartless seller's lawyer, realtor, and bank decided that they were ready to close just yesterday. Suffice it to say that I have even less respect for banks and lawyers than I had before, which was not a great deal to begin with. At any rate, we finally closed yesterday, and I'm here writing this month's frivolity for you guys. I'm not quite sure who is more nuts, me for writing this, or you guys for listening to my meanderings, but I thank you for your allegiance nonetheless. Tonight I will cover a couple of science stories, but I will also be reviewing a new science book, which I have not done in a while. In fact, the first story of the evening, as you'll see in a few minutes, is actually related to the book in a rather tangential way. I once had a friend who said that both men and women are drawn to beautiful women. That is, both men and women objectify the female body. I was puzzled by this comment, especially since my friend was basically a feminist. But she clarified. She said that men obviously want to possess beautiful women in a sexual way, but the desire of one heterosexual woman for another is something entirely different. This made me even more puzzled because I was young and naive at the time, and it never occurred to me that one woman would have any interest in the body of another woman. However, my friend, an anthropology major, if I remember correctly, explained that the desire of one heterosexual woman for another has to do with a desire for a more perfect body. My friend told me that women are drawn to beautiful female bodies because they want to possess them for their own. They want that perfect body. I have no idea what truth there is to that. My friend insisted that every woman, no matter how perfect she is, sees only her flaws and always desires a more perfect body, whether it be better hair, better breasts, better legs, better tummy, etc. Well, in a recent paper by Dr. Sarah Gervais from the University of Nebraska, which was published in the European Journal of Social Psychology, we find an examination of how men and women actually perceive female bodies. And it is interesting that both sexes pretty much size up a female body in much the same way. After viewing dozens of images of male and female bodies, participants in Gervais' study were shown two new side-by-side images, one an exact duplicate of a previously viewed image, and the other a slightly modified version of the original showing a sexual body part. The participants were then asked which of the two images they had previously seen. Once the results were analyzed, the researchers found that women's sexual body parts were more easily recognized when shown in isolation and separate from the entire body. However, men's sexual body parts, on the other hand, were more recognizable in the context of the entire body. What does that mean? It suggests that because your brain perceives an object as being either a coherent entity or a collection of parts, you rely on two different cognitive processes, what the authors call global and local scanning. It also appears that which of those scanning processes you use depends on whether you're gazing upon a woman or a man. When you, male or female, look at a woman, you see her as consisting of various body parts. But if it's a man, you tend to see him as a single whole. And this makes sense. A male, upon seeing a woman, objectifies her and sizes up her parts, either consciously or unconsciously, as a potential mate. This is evolution, ladies and gentlemen, and wired in programming. But why are women doing this objectifying scanning process? Why are women lumping other women in with cars and trees and houses in their scanning analysis as objects? I suspect it goes beyond the analysis my anthropologist friend suggested to me decades ago. Yes, women all want to possess beautiful bodies, but that is not why they are scoping out other women as men do. From a reproductive and evolutionary standpoint, what makes the most sense is that they are comparing themselves to the competition. Does that other woman have better breasts, legs, arms, face, etc. than I do? Is she competition with me for my mate? Is she good enough looking to cause me trouble? Dr. Gervais says that even though our responses are hardwired, both men and women can overcome the objectification in visual analysis. She says, quote, "Knowing that your brain takes gender into account when looking at a person can help you understand why you're seeing a person in a certain light, and how you can change your behavior accordingly. It's quite possible, for example, that these responses are reinforced by social conditioning, that is, popular culture and media, and by knowing our potential for this process, we can short-circuit it." Unquote. Next story. According to Dr. Henry Sauerman from Georgia Institute of Technology, in the latest issue of the journal PLOS ONE, PhD students in science are having trouble getting academic jobs and aren't being prepared for other career options. At the moment, we have a glut of graduates who are getting science doctorates around the world. And even though most of them expect and hope to get jobs teaching and doing research at a university, most will not. Sauerman surveyed PhD students about their interest in various career options from academia, government, and private industry. As a result, he found that biology, chemistry, and physics students often lost interest in faculty teaching and research jobs during their studies. I really can't blame them. It turns out that only about 1 in 4 ever gets a teaching job, and that's the average. The breakdown for each area of science is even worse. Specifically, the biology PhDs have the most competition. According to the National Science Foundation, just 14% of PhDs in the biological sciences hold tenure-track positions 5 to 6 years after graduation. Biology is the lowest number compared to 21% for physicists and 23% for chemists. You would think it is simply a reflection of very few academic jobs that are out there, but Sauerman says, no, that's not the case. Quote, "No, there are a large number of positions, but given the number of people looking for them, the chances of getting one is pretty rare," unquote. Meanwhile, doctoral advisors continue to push their students toward academic careers, which Sauerman says is, quote, "dysfunctional because it exacerbates the labor imbalances." These advisors are responsible for more than just a student's doctoral research project. There's also a role in them for shaping career decisions and perceptions of what careers will look like. Unquote. I know my own university department has been discussing starting a doctoral program for quite a while, and among the issues that have been brought up is the glut of graduates out there with doctorates. We just can't convince ourselves that it's fair to students to educate them and send them out into an already crowded field. The analogy would be how difficult it would be to justify opening a new Starbucks coffee house when there are already 5 within a block of you. Next story. Here is one thing you may not know about me. I am a first-degree black belt in the Japanese martial art of Iaido. Iaido is not a hand-to-hand martial art. It is a sword art that has been compared to the quick draw of the gunslinger from the Old West. Every one of our kata, or practice forms, is performed from a starting position where the sword is sheathed and must be pulled out for immediate use. It took me 10 years to get pretty good at the use of the sword. As my teacher says, Iaido is an art where there is so much subtlety that you continually make bad habits in order to fix them and make good habits. People have asked me why I bother to learn such an archaic art. It's not like I'm likely to get into any sword fights in New Jersey. My answer is simple and twofold. First, just like any ancient art, by learning and mastering it, you keep it alive so it can be passed along to the next generation. In that sense, it's an honor and duty to perfect these arts. And second, if science fiction writers S.M. Sterling and J.J. Abrams are right, then we should all be prepared to defend ourselves without the luxury of firearms in case the light of civilization ever goes out. What is the apparently completely off-topic point I'm making? Learning new skills can be hard. It takes time and, above all, practice. Only through a gradual process of trial and error do we acquire the ability to walk, speak, or play the trumpet. This process is called motor skill learning, and it involves two structures within the brain called an actor, which adjusts the behavior of the animal, and a critic, which monitors the effects of the adjustments and compares them with the desired outcome. The interaction between the two brain regions results in a reinforcement of the adjustments made by the actor that the critic thinks will take the behavior closer toward the desired outcome until practice has indeed been made perfect. In short, once you understand what you should be doing correctly, you self-adjust and fix it. You do this over and over and over until you've mastered the process. We've all experienced this. The reason I brought up Iaido at all is that for a decade I've been taught in exactly the way described. You learn the basic sword and body movements, and then refine and refine and refine until they approach the ideal in your head. However, this manner of teaching and learning physical skills is not quite what we believe it to be. A paper published this month in the journal Nature by Dr. Jonathan Charlesworth examines the neurophysiological hypothesis that the gradual changes implemented by the actor are an important part of this learning, and that the critic monitors progress by feedback received from the movements that are generated as a result of these changes. Apparently, he finds some evidence that disputes the hypothesis. Finches can be trained to change the pitch of their song. It's a slow process of motor skill learning, requiring the anterior forebrain pathway as the actor area and the dopaminergic neurons within the basal ganglia as the critic area. Researchers tested whether the adjustments implemented by the anterior forebrain pathway actor were required in the training process by blocking the output of the actor to the critic motor system with a drug before training. So essentially, they cut off communication between the actor and the critic. As expected, the finches did not gradually change their song in response to the training regime when the drug was applied. However, when the authors removed the drug, the birds immediately produced a perfectly modified pitch. The finches, therefore, skipped all the steps that they normally take during the training process and instantly went from novices to experts. The findings suggested that the step-by-step improvements normally seen during training are not required for learning. It would be like being given a drug, teaching a newbie to pitch a curveball, taking the drug away, and then finding that the newbie pitches a perfect curve. However, when the team disrupted neuronal activity within the actor itself during training, and did not just disrupt communications, they found that not only was there no gradual improvement, but also the birds did not modify their songs after the drug was removed. They concluded that inactivating the actor area completely interferes with learning, suggesting that activity within the circuit is required during learning. These findings show that finches can modify their song even without gradual improvements, suggesting that the critic does not monitor the consequences of the actor's adjustments. So how does the critic brain area know whether to tell the actor it is improving? The authors speculate it is not the animal's movements that the critic looks at, but the underlying brain activity instead. The critic probably receives a representation of the activity of the motor system, what the authors call a efference copy, which it uses to identify successful adjustments. The study takes a huge leap forward toward identifying the neuronal mechanisms underlying motor skill learning. Just don't think it'll help you become the next BB King. You're still going to have to practice. Okay, I promised you a book review. I was a bit skeptical when this new science book was recommended to me, but try to control your snickering as I tell you the title. The book is by Florence Williams, who is not a scientist, but she is an excellent writer, and very thoughtful, and from what I can see, more thorough than most scientists I have read. The title of the book is Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. The book was published in the last couple of months of 2012 from W.W. Norton & Company of New York and London. Again, you may chuckle a bit and wonder why I'm recommending or reading a book about boobs, but the book is far more than that. It's not lascivious or prurient in any way. Just as that statement is going to encourage some of you to read it, I suspect many of you will be just as disappointed by it. The book covers many topics about breasts in language any common person can understand. It's not a scientific tome, and when she does talk about science, Williams is very accessible. The first topic she covers in the book deals with the big question of why human females are the only mammal with breasts that are always visible. For those of you who do not remember, one of the ways that mammals are defined, besides fur and warm blood, is by our milk production. You may not know this, but every other mammalian female has a swelling in the breasts, making them visible only when she is producing milk. They reduce down to the same size as the male of the species the rest of the time. Human female breasts swell during pregnancy and breastfeeding, and they do reduce in size, but they are quite visible the rest of the time as well. So why is it different in humans? Williams suggests two different possibilities. After traveling around the world to talk to leading evolutionary biologists and anthropologists, I figure, by the way, that she must have gotten a huge advance from Norton to do all the traveling she did. In New Zealand, she speaks with Doctors Allen and Barnaby Dixon, who are leaders in research that suggests that breasts are used in humans as sexual signals. They are courtship devices born out of our competition and selection. Quote, the Dixons believe that enlarged breasts are seductive adornments, advertising genetic quality. Those who attracted the best mates had fitter offspring and ultimately larger number of descendants, so the trait of large breasts persisted. This is the essence of sexual selection as posited by Charles Darwin. Unquote. The Dixons also explained that the health and perkiness of the breast tissue is going to indicate the age of the woman and whether she's likely young enough and healthy enough to have children. Saggy breasts that have been exposed to gravity and age are going to be less attractive to a mate. Williams goes on to discuss the alternative hypothesis to what she calls the old boys network idea. She and other female researchers have insisted that male scientists, even though they deny it, are so obsessed with the breast itself as a sexual object that they can't see the forest for the trees. Williams interviews one of my neighbors at Rutgers University, Dr. Francis Masha Lees, who says the breast as a sex signal hypothesis is nonsense. Quote, if firm, big breasts tell a man that a woman is fertile and ready for sex, then why would her breasts be biggest and firmest when she's already pregnant and lactating? Why is there such a variation in human breast size and shape? And why are so many women with tiny breasts spectacularly successful at nursing, childbirth, and child rearing? Unquote. Masha Lees says that breasts developed through natural selection, not sexual selection. Williams states the argument quite nicely. Quote, it seems perfectly reasonable, if not more reasonable, to suppose that there was something about having breasts that increased the fitness of the woman and her offspring. Male interest was secondary. Breasts help increase a woman's fat reserves. In the poor or unpredictable environment of our early evolution, those extra fat depots could have made the difference in being able to sustain pregnancy and lactation. Unquote. There is a lot more to that argument and a lot more detail to support it, but you may want to read the book and find that out for yourself. But the book does not just delve into the natural history of the breast, it also examines how humans have messed around with its natural history through accident or on purpose over the last 50 years or so. Williams gives the entire history of the surgical breast implant, as well as some of its prehistory. She interviews the medical leaders of the breast implant movement in Houston, Texas, where it all began. But what blew me completely away was that Williams finds out who the first woman to get a breast implant in 1962 was, Timmy Jean Lindsay. Williams tracks her down some 50 years later and interviews her. You will really want to read the interview. Timmy Jean is like a survivor of the Hindenburg or the Titanic crash. The details of her story are just amazing. In a chapter called Spring Comes Early, Williams spends quite a bit of time on what is causing our female children to grow up earlier than ever before and start breast development, as well as what is causing our sons to be ever more infertile. The short answer is a multitude of man-made chemicals in our environment. As any frequent listener to this podcast knows, I've been crusading for years against the evils of bisphenol A, the estrogen-mimicking chemical in most of our plastics. BPA and dozens more chemicals like it are making our environment a toxic sludge of additives that are messing up not only the bodies of the older among us, possibly leading to cancer and infertility, but the youngest among us as well. One of the fascinating little experiments that Williams does in the book, along with her young daughter, is a chemical body burden test. Williams goes wild for 3 days using lots of lotions and fragrances and getting her nails done with the usual load of chemicals, etc. She then takes a sample of her blood and sends it off for analysis of her body burden of toxic compounds. After that, she goes on a chemical fast where she does not drive in her car for 3 days, plastic seats, off-gas chemicals, uses no shampoo or fragranced lotions, avoids meat and cheeses wrapped in plastics, avoids water from bottles or even water from the tap because it is likely contaminated, goes to no stores because the store receipts have BPA in high levels, eats no food at all that comes into contact with plastics, uses no sunglasses with BPA plastic, uses no computer with a plastic keyboard, and avoids lipstick and deodorant. After the detox, she then took her blood sample again to send it in for analysis. I will leave it for the book to tell you the details, but surprisingly, even for so unscientific a study, she got very clear results where her body burden of most estrogenic toxins dropped after only 3 days. If it's true that we are awash in a sea of toxins, at least we know we can lower our burden of those known toxins if we really intend to. The real worry is that the exposome, as some scientists are calling it, is not very well documented. In other words, we do not even know all the toxins that are out there in our environment because the U.S. government has only demanded that maybe 1 out of 100 be tested. In an interview in the book, Dr. George Bittner of the University of Texas suggests that it may be impossible to make a plastic that does not have some estrogenic chemical factors in it. Quote, Bittner and his colleagues chopped up hundreds of products ranging from plastic wrap to soda bottles and storage containers. They broke down each of them in a saline solution and fed those to tissue cultures of estrogen-sensitive breast cancer cells. Over 90% of the extracts made cancer cells grow, including many that are supposed to be BPA-free. There may be hundreds, if not thousands, of chemicals used to make plastics that have estrogenic activity. Unquote. Williams does a nice job of covering important topics like breast development, lactation, breastfeeding, and breast cancer, which comes up again and again throughout the book, even though it has a chapter all to itself. She is a thorough, humorous, and entertaining writer who covers an amazing amount of ground in her book. I do recommend this. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Stay away from, everything. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.